You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have the great Professor Adam Grant, organizational psychologist out of Wharton Business School. Just stop me, Adam, when I'm wrong. He's done it again. He writes a book called Give and Take, which takes, you know, the world by storm. If you haven't read it, then you're just not cool. At least you don't have a cool brain, apparently. But The Originals is his new book. I've recommended it, I think, to everybody. Everybody from my wife to friends, everybody I know has read it. And I was kind of blown away. You know, when Malcolm Gladwell says, an insightful, wonderful new take on the world from one of my favorite thinkers, that you're doing your job, Grant. So I guess interview is over. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure to hear. This is my favorite interview I've ever done with you, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. I just love the idea. I'm actually applying this stuff to how I raise my kids. You go through how originals were raised. Instead of just scolding them now, I try to explain why they shouldn't do something in terms of how it affects other people, etc., etc. But let's start this interview with what we were talking about before we started recording, which was, you know, I asked you how many books you'd read, and you kind of probably lost track, and now you don't read all the books all the way to the end. And I said, you know, for me, when I've got to do come up with a new one-hour special, which I'm in the process of doing now, comedy-wise, I have to sit down and actually think abstractly or key into what I really care about and what really motivates me, what I'm afraid of, what I'm ashamed of, who I'm pretending to be, et cetera, et cetera. And I always find that I really like to procrastinate by reading a bunch of other people's thoughts and ideas, and suddenly I have to read every editorial in the New York Times, and I have to do and then, of course, I have to exercise because my body feels a little tight. And so you were talking about how you know plenty of academics who should be writing original works, and instead they're filling their brains with everybody else's information.
Yeah, you know, I just thought that this was an excuse that comedians use to not work. But
It is. Yeah.
It turns out that it's also really productive. I just have to say as an aside, like, next time you're on the New York Times website, after I wrote this thing on raising creative children, I discovered that every single New York Times reader has a gifted child. Which is so cool. Like, who knew that, right?
That's so funny. I love
it. Why do they even bother doing, like, IQ tests or anything like that? They should just have a one-word questionnaire. Does your parent read the New York Times? And then it's like, definitely gifted.
Yeah, right.
And then we can get to genius level by, does your parent take the time to write comments on the New York Times website?
About what a rare and special, unique flower you are.
Yeah. I'm so careful not to do that with my kids. I always, when they're in earshot, the only thing I say is, I'll tell you, man, she works hard. She never gives up. She just, no matter what, she'll just always keep working, and she just doesn't give up. She just loves to grind away. And I kind of create that mythology in her own mind, because I'd rather have a kid that just works hard and keeps going than thinks they're special. I think that's detrimental.
I love the sound of that. It sounds like you're gonna raise an unusually gritty child with no purpose in life whatsoever.
He's gonna raise a Russian.
Listen, I will definitely screw my own kids up in my own way. I mean, come on, it's one big mistake.
But when Stalingrad 2 happens, let me tell you, Stella Callen is gonna be ready for it.
She'll be ready. My wife said it the other day. She goes, "We're gonna screw our kids up in our own special way, no matter what we do." So, you know.
Well, that's better than in somebody else's less special way. Brian, I'm curious to hear you. So you talk about procrastinating and actually getting ideas.
Yeah.
What is it that you read that actually helps you generate new comedy? Like, is there a method to this madness, or is it literally a random walk down the internet?
I actually think that at this point, I've been doing it so long that I believe in inspiration. So when I see a book like yours, there's something about it I have to read. I just want to see if I'm in good company, or I want to see if I'm doing something wrong, or at least it's just interesting so I can pass it along to somebody. So inspiration, whether it's listening to a great piece of music or going out and working out, I like the way I procrastinate and productively, to be honest, is I do something that's very difficult and scary. So I'll box and I force myself to spar with somebody who's good because I'm afraid to get hit. And when I put myself in that position, the other day I rode a horse for this thing we were shooting, and I cantered. I just decided to kick it into gear and ran up this hill and ran around. And I haven't ridden in years, but that kind of, when I do things that I'm not sure I can do, it seems to open up new channels. I'm not as comfortable, and it shakes something up in my paradigm. And somehow the next day or even right after that, I'm coming up with new ideas. When I feel not so good about myself, I just did Tim Tebow's foundation and offended him, and I was asked to apologize to him. He's a good guy, and his foundation's amazing. But there are some sick kids in the audience, and my comedy, he felt, was a little inappropriate. I heard through the grapevine. I didn't feel so good about myself. But this morning, I wrote a whole bunch of really good stuff. So that's, I guess, the answer to the question.
Wow. All right. Yeah. So if I heard you right, you said when you need to shake things up in your brain, you get punched in the face a bunch of times.
That's exactly right, in one way or another. And I'm being serious. Yes. When I'm off my pins and not so comfortable, I do things that surprise myself. I don't believe, Adam, that, you know, if you want to be really creative, I don't think loving yourself is a prerequisite. In fact, maybe it's a detriment.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Brian, you have opened up a real can of worms here, right? Because, I mean, what you're basically saying is that complacency doesn't push you to improve.
No. And also, you know, Immanuel Kant, I'll quote because I'm very educated, said, we are constructed from...
We were talking about this before the show, and you called him Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, Immanuel Kant. But he said we are, I'm going to paraphrase, but we are made from broken timber. This is a Christian idea, probably, and maybe a Judeo-Christian notion, that why start with the idea that you're special? Maybe it's best to think of yourself as a blind, broken wretch, and especially somebody who has competing interests and values and virtues and vices that are always going on within the brain. So you're always sort of, or your heart or whatever you want to call it, you're always kind of having to adjust. I think that that's a better place to start when you want to try to be original, in my opinion. I don't think, you know, Harriet Dora won the National Book Award. Somebody said, were you happy being a housewife for 35 years? And she said, could you repeat the question? And then said, were you happy being a housewife for 35 years? And she said, I've never heard of anybody being happy for 35 years. And why would anybody who was happy write a book? And I never forgot that. So that's, yeah. Yeah.
This is convincing me all the more that I need to continue teaching myself to procrastinate.
Well, yeah, you talk about how you are the farthest thing from a procrastinator, and in fact, you go to the opposite extreme. Yet, Adam, let's be honest, you are an original thinker. I mean, come on, you've written these two books, and I've read them pretty thoroughly, and they are. It's rare that you find a book with all the information out there that really makes a splash. And you've done it twice now. And so whatever you're doing seems to be working, man. I mean, and I really love just how you break down, the chapters, Creative Destruction, Blind Inventors and One-Eyed Investors, Out on a Limb, Speaking Truth to Power, Fools Rush In. I thought it was really interesting that a lot of great entrepreneurs are not daring. They're not like, you know, I'm going to throw everything to the wind. I'm going out in the middle of the ocean with no oars. Let's go. I'm going to take the storm on. No, in fact, they're very, very careful. Like you use the example of Warby Parker, and these guys weren't even going to quit their day jobs. They were dipping their toe in to these new waters and really letting their bodies acclimate to the temperature before they actually dove right in. They did a whole bunch of research. So they're pretty careful, successful entrepreneurs, right?
It sounds like you read the book.
I read it. I always make sure I read the book. There's nothing more obnoxious than when somebody takes the time to write a book like this, which is always an act of faith, and then you don't read the book, you read the footnotes and then interview somebody with your brain. I'm not going to do that.
That's overly generous of you, as usual. Yeah, I mean, look, I was surprised by this too, right? Like, I've always been an incredibly risk-averse person, and My roommates and I in college, like, we all had these ideas that some of which we thought were pretty good. We built one of the first online social networks as seniors in high school. And then I just thought, like, I'm not one of those crazy risk takers, so I'm not going to ever be an entrepreneur, and I'm not going to do this. And then, of course, like, Mark Zuckerberg comes around and starts Facebook, and the door next door a couple of years later.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I was just going to say, Adam Grant almost created Facebook.
No, I mean, I didn't have any of the vision for how this would play out. But it was striking to me that I never would have even considered becoming an entrepreneur, because I just thought, I'm not one of those daredevils. And then I read all these studies showing that, yeah, there are a lot of entrepreneurs who take crazy risks, but those are the ones who fail as opposed to the ones who succeed.
Right. That was fascinating to me.
Donald Trump. No, yeah. But I mean, that's the idea of entrepreneur as swashbuckling pirate.
Yeah.
You know, that is really what Donald Trump is selling. And there you need the fertile ground of the American public believing that that's what an entrepreneur looks like.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of someone like, yeah, a lot of the people, the Warby Parker guys, who are like, okay, let's evaluate this. Let's not burn our bridges behind us. Let's make sure that we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, although let's be clear, right? You do have to have a lot of bad ideas in order to do something truly original.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I loved about what I love this. This I've been quoting this since I read the book. I had no idea that the original thinkers, from Beethoven to, you know, Picasso, had created so much work. Picasso created something like 12,000 sculptures and 10,000 paintings, and we talk about probably 12 of them. And Beethoven is the same thing. The amount of work that guy created, when we really talk about 6 pieces of his work, that was fascinating to me. Talk about that a little bit.
I found it stunning. I mean, I just thought that these geniuses, like, yeah, they had one big idea at a time, and then, you know, they went and, like, dreamed it into perfection.
Right.
And that could not be further from the truth. It was so fun. Thomas Edison was the greatest example of this.
Yeah.
He designed a talking doll so creepy it scared not only kids but adults too. Like, I have had nightmares looking at pictures of this doll that he created. Yeah. And, you know, he worked on it around the same time he was perfecting the light bulb, and he tried to mine iron ore with magnets. That didn't work. He had a fruit preservation technique that failed. And you just have to generate a lot of volume in order to get the sheer variety that's necessary to stumble on something truly new. And most of us never get there. We either fall in love with our third idea, which is usually the most obvious one. That's why I thought of it first. Or, you know, we just think, I'm out of steam and I don't want to fail, so I'm going to stop.
I spoke to a producer who's a big producer, has worked with big time, you know, produced huge movies. And he said he'd liked something I wrote. And I said, yeah, I wrote a one act and it did pretty well. And he said, you need to keep writing. I said, I know, but, you know, I've written so many things and they just all suck. And I just got lucky on this one. He said, Brian, I've worked with the biggest, best writers in Hollywood over 20 years. All of them have literally a giant trunk full of scripts that were a disaster, that didn't work. There is no such thing as, and I never forget, again, it's like, I guess it's another way of saying, if you want to be really original and really good, it's got to be on your mind all the time, and you kind of have to be doing it all the time, which then really kind of raises the question, and Hunter, one of Hunter's things about, you know, genius and being smart, quote unquote. Well, maybe it is just consistent and correct effort.
Yeah, I mean, Adam, I don't know how familiar you are with Joe Henrich and his work at Harvard.
I am, yeah. He's done some really cool work on sort of complicating the 10,000-hour principle.
Yeah, and just in general, I mean, you know, it seems there, you know, the one of the things that I love from the beginning of the book is that he has this, you know, they did an IQ test on an orangutan and a toddler and a chimpanzee. And what you find is that in causal reasoning and in spatial reasoning, essentially there's no difference between a chimp or an orangutan and a human toddler. The one area in which the human toddler is different is social intelligence. Mm. And so what you really end up finding is that what makes humans special is the ability to acquire culture. And the question is, you know, if you look around the world and you remove your value judgments of what are the right rituals and what are the important symbols and all of this stuff, you find everybody has a culture. Academia is a culture. Mm. You know, there are magic totems. There are markers of who is a high priest. And then there are rituals, which are calculus and knowing certain books and all of that stuff. And so I think that's the thing is that there are a lot of people who never feel like they can be initiates into the tribe of really original thinkers. And so they never pursue that craft with the same tenacity that, you know, people who don't have anything on it or are willing to have a go really do.
Mm. Yeah, there's so much truth to that. I mean, I think I always thought that if you wanted to do something original, you had to be fearless. And I've been stunned. You know, you talk to these great innovators and entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Larry Page and others. And one of the things I heard consistently from them is they were afraid of failing just like the rest of us were. Mm-hmm. They were just even more afraid of failing to try. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you just have to sometimes put your work out there, generate a bunch of ideas and see if anything sticks.
Yeah, that's so nice to hear, because every time I shoot a 1-hour special or, you know, I just shot these 12 episodes, I can barely watch it because I'm just so afraid it's going to suck. And then when people do like it, it's always such a surprise. But I mean, it's nice to, again, that's what's so cool about the book, is if you're trying really hard to do something, you know, you kind of realize that I always get this feeling, like, Adam, like when I'm around people, like, for example, sometimes you just see somebody like Elon Musk, and his kid used to go to my kid's school, and you know, he's like tall and he's got long legs, and I was like, that guy, life just comes easier. He gets places faster. He's got longer bones, and I'm just.
I don't think anyone has ever had that thought.
Well, I have.
It's again, there are recurring patterns in Brian's thinking, and limb length is a big one.
Of course, I come from a long line of peasantry and petty crime, and you know, but you get this idea that man, life must be much easier for that person, and they're a genius, or they're an original thinker, and here I am. Like, I let me ask you this. I guess this is a better question. You know, I feel like everything I've accomplished, it requires just literally like all of me. Like, I feel like I'm the guy who scratches just to get a tiny bit of whatever. You know, like, my 1-hour special took me probably 2.5-3 years of work, and I still hate it.
Well, that's just, I mean, that's just lack of talent, right? I can't help you there.
Adam, for God's sake, I'm a fragile man.
I'm so sorry. No, I mean, I think that's the reality of how every original thinker works, right? And like, we all toil away for years at things that, you know, we feel like we've only produced a tiny fraction from all, you know, of all the effort that we put in. You know, like I've met writers who will literally write from scratch something 12 times before they even begin like working on it for real.
Wow.
And it's like, okay, I only threw away one draft of a book from scratch, but it still feels like a lot.
Yeah.
Well, but isn't it also just a disparity in information, Brian, because you're immensely aware of all the things that you have done to make that 1-hour special and have little to no understanding of what Elon Musk has done to achieve that?
That's
you don't know what
point.
He thinks. And so what happens is the human mind abhors a vacuum. And so you're like, I know these things about Elon Musk. And then you fill it in with, you know, your own prejudices and your own insecurities and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you invent, you know, Elon Musk as mythical man rather than...
Hunter, it's such an interesting theory, because like limb length is way more visible than idea volume.
Exactly.
Than idea volume. Yes, it is.
No, but so much of this stuff, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. All of this stuff really comes down to, there's a huge bias for humans in terms of attributing success to visual things rather than in things that are done, you know, hit in a hidden way. I mean, you know, when kids want to look smart, they like wear glasses because they're like, oh, smart kids wear glasses. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, people want to have big hair because Einstein had big hair, you know, or, you know, Michael Jordan is standing next to a McDonald's hamburger. So it's like, what is the source of his success? Is the source of his success the immense amount of basketball practice that he does and the, you know, abstemious way in which he eats? Or is it the McDonald's hamburger that happens to be placed next to him?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way that humans think. And so, you know, but it's, I think what's always fascinating about this stuff is how people fill in those blanks, because that tells you so much. Brian fills in person with limb length. And like that tells you everything
and
about
hair.
Brian.
And hair.
And these are Brian's insecurities. See, I would fill in a totally different way. For me, it would be like, oh, you know, like, I mean, God, do I really have to bear my insecurities on air?
But, do it.
Yeah, I would say it's probably like, yeah, probably more self-discipline or something like that. Mm. You know, I don't, the fear thing about having, you know, being fearless or anything like that, that's not me particularly. Mm. Or like having more knowledge of business. Those would be my sort of insecurities that I would fill in with, but yeah.
So interesting. I don't have any insecurities, so I can't play this game. But
and by the way, Adam's sitting on a throne, an ivory throne.
You mean a toilet?
It's a band ivory that he bought with it, the proceeds from the originals. The book is killing it, right? I mean, I mean, New York Times best. How are you doing with this? Are people? Because I've been recommending it, and I just think it's so important for people to read a book like this. It's so important because it gives you an idea that, you know, you can do something. Like the people that you think are the great geniuses are probably just like you. But maybe they're just too afraid not to keep going. I mean, I think a healthy ego, but also at the same time being humble enough to realize that you need to work just as hard as anybody is both important, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, all joking aside, I'm totally honored that you read the book and that you found it worthy of recommending. I'm a little worried now about what's going to happen to all these people who read it and don't want to work with you anymore. but that aside, that was the really empowering thing that I walked away with, which is like these people who do truly original things in the world, who drive creativity and change, are not that different from the rest of us. Mm. You know, they feel the same fears and doubts. They worry about taking risks. They procrastinate. They have bad ideas. And it's like, well, maybe like more of us could be like that.
Mm. Yeah, I think the way that I always think about a lot of this stuff, because, you know, when we wrote our book, the beginning of it is really dealing with a lot of these genius myths that float around about, you know, Edison having 1,000 patents and all that stuff. And Edison did have 1,000 patents, but he had a huge team of people who worked under him, and he made sure that his name was on all those patents because he's not going to let somebody else have their name on the IP. But I think the general principle is always, because you don't have time, there's no way that any human can sort through all of these genius myths, but you can always apply the mother-in-law principle. You know, when you hear people talk about their own mother-in-law, they're like, she's a fire-breathing she-devil. And when you hear people talk about their own mothers, they're like, she's a saint who has never done anything wrong. She's better than Mother Teresa. And the truth is, we all know that this person is probably a person and has, you know, good points and bad points. Yeah. And we should try and figure out what the good points are and avoid the bad points. Because even Edison, I mean, Henry Ford once described Edison as the world's greatest inventor and the world's worst businessman.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think all of these guys, they're people. And they have...
Adam, when that's a really good point. Every time Hunter talks, I'm trying to memorize it so I can drop it as knowledge among people who I'm trying to impress. But Adam, when you started writing this book, take us through the process of sort of why you came up with this idea, why you chose to write it, and what you kind of learned. Because, I mean... Did you start out by saying, I'm going to write a book about original thinkers, or what was the genesis of this? How did this come about, and what did you kind of latch onto that forced you and made you want to kind of keep exploring this? What was surprising to you?
I mean, the major reason that I wrote the book was, like, I could not tolerate another day talking about give and take. I actually enjoy, like, even though it's been a few years since those ideas came out, what I love about sharing old stuff is that you feel like, you know, you've gotten closer to giving a great performance, mm-hmm. right? It's like in your world of stand-up comedy, it's like the joke that you know kills, mm-hmm. right? Even if you heard it before, like you still feel like you're doing something of value by making the audience laugh.
Yeah.
But I was ready to start doing something fresh. I didn't want to get typecast anymore as like the nice guys finish first guy,
mm-hmm.
Which is not the message I intended to deliver anyway. But,
right, right.
I'd been working on some research about how to challenge the status quo. And, you know, as somebody who was always uncomfortable not following rules and disagreeing with authority figures, I had kind of been like on a personal journey to get more comfortable, you know, speaking up for my ideas, even if other people would disagree with them.
Mm.
And I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to answer questions from students about, you know, if I join an organization, but I'm not the boss, how do I get heard? And then the more work I did with leaders, the more frequently I was asked, like, how do I fight groupthink? How do I get more innovation? And I kind of put all that together and said, you know, this is a topic I really need to tackle.
Yeah. Well, to talk about that, how do you fight groupthink? Because you have an amazing example of that woman in the CIA who, you know, and it's in the chapter Speaking Truth to Power. She had this radical idea of having, you know, agents internally share ideas with their own sort of secret website, I guess, or kind of almost like a Facebook thing where they could swap ideas and points of view, which was really considered insane. And when she started speaking up, she got demoted essentially or put in no man's land and then finally found her way through. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this happens everywhere. It happened to me when I was working, and a lot of people have, you know, faced this situation where you have this idea that you think is really important. You share it, and then you find out that not only have you gotten silenced, but it's set your career backward. Mm. And, you know, I think Carmen Medina learned a few things from that experience, which I wish I had known at the time when I had my disastrous experience, which you will notice I'm not talking about.
I don't want to get it out of
you. That is not a coincidence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was too traumatic. Okay. But she first realized that you have to earn status before you can exercise power. Mm. You know, you're an entry-level employee and you go, you know, telling other people how to run their organization. They tend not to like that, strangely.
Right.
And they find it threatening. So, you know, she found that following sort of the Francis Ford Coppola advice to become the establishment before double-crossing them mm-hmm. worked out really well. Mm-hmm. You know, and sort of demonstrate that she had a track record of success in caring about the CIA before she was, you know, advocating for these risky ideas of creating an internal intranet.
Yeah, let's pause for a second, because that's an important point. When, you know, when Coppola talks about that, and I've heard other filmmakers talk about that, you've got to learn, if you want to double cross the genre, if you want to change how you tell a story, you've got to understand thoroughly how traditionally a story is told. You've got to learn the principles that go into good storytelling and traditional storytelling. And it's a little bit the same thing Carmen had to kind of...
But I think it's more than that. This comes down to social intelligence. You have to prove, oh, I am a member of the group.
Gotcha.
I care about the group and all that stuff. Because I think when you know, I mean, as I was reading that, what I kept on thinking about is when the West tries to talk to Arabs about the problems with Islam, you have no status within Islam or within the Arab community. And you're coming in and being like, here's what's wrong with, you know, yes. Islam and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I mean... Partly those reforms work best within a group, but mm-hmm. also, you know, you first have to mark your respect for the tradition that you like, the tradition that, you know, you see the value in the tradition. And then once you've said, like, oh, there are all these great things about it, but let's talk about this other thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's so much easier for people to accept an original idea when it comes from someone who's proven, you know, I'm one of you. I care mm-hmm. about the group. I love this term for it. It's called optimal distinctiveness, which is totally not memorable. But
like so many things created by academics.
Yeah, optimal distinctiveness. Turn it into a t-shirt and sell none of them.
Yeah, so the way it should have been marketed was it's the tension between fitting in and standing out. Mm-hmm. And you have to show that you fit in sometimes before you get the license to stand out.
Mm.
Right. Right.
That's awesome.
That takes patience. But probably you would learn something anyway when you know, there's a reason things have been done that way for a long time.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's kind of comes down to respect and social intelligence. That makes total sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the thing is, in general, you know, because we are children of the Enlightenment, you know, we've placed a real value on facts and numbers and all of that sort of stuff, and really to the detriment of paying attention to things like trust and feelings and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up happening is, I mean, you know, I don't think that Richard Dawkins is a force for good in society, because he goes around and he insults all these people. And when you're focused on a purely factual analysis, yes, you know, he has a great understanding of the facts of evolution. But when you insult people, you destroy trust in that relationship, and then it becomes difficult for those ideas to to be communicated. Like Richard Dawkins speaking to religious people about evolution does not have optimal distinctiveness.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
And do you think Donald Trump falls in that category as well?
Well, exactly. But, you know, there are... anyway, I mean, I think that's the thing. I think, obviously, part of this book is that it appeals to us as individuals in the West looking mm-hmm. to be creative and all that sort of stuff. But it has so much broad applicability in terms of international relations because it's all just human psychology playing mm-hmm. out again and again.
Adam, in your opinion, have we ever had an original thinker in office?
Gosh. I mean, it's so hard to... First of all, if you're really original, I don't know why you want that job.
Right.
Secondly, I think that politics squashes a lot of the original thoughts that people do have mm-hmm. on their way into office. I would put my money on Abraham Lincoln if you want to go far back.
Always and say, look, a safe like,
to,
answer.
To have both the confidence and the courage to build a team of rivals and reach across party lines to bring some of your enemies into your cabinet, that's original thought. To question, you know, the long-standing tradition of slavery and ask, is this right for the country? And is there a way to, you know, to repeal this without causing, you know, an irreparable chasm? Mm-hmm. Like, pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing, too. I've just been listening to Thomas Sowell's book, Black Rednecks and White Liberals. And part of what he makes, you know, there are people who take issue with what Lincoln did. And they sort of, you know, look back to a mythical past and are like, on day one, he should have freed all the slaves. And they're, you know, frustrated that it took him two whole years to write the Emancipation Proclamation and that it wasn't more sweeping. But the fact that...
Who are these people?
I know.
Who sits around with that shit?
But I mean, you know, Lincoln, I think, is a really great example of someone who's able to be an idealist but also a pragmatist and figure out how to implement his ideas within the political realities of his time. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a case to be made that if he had acted earlier, it would have literally torn the country apart.
Yeah.
As, you know, as opposed to, you know, having a war, yes, but a war that got resolved with a united set of states.
And at least until 2016.
No comment.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I like the chapter on Dean Kamen's segue in the book. That was wild to me.
And it's also just so helpful to hear that Steve Jobs made the wrong bet.
Well, so did everybody. Yeah. Everybody was like wanted to put their money into. I think Jobs wanted to put $63 million or something into the Segway, and this is going to change transportation. The problem was none of them knew anything about transportation. So if you want to be an original thinker, you better kind of have an idea of what sort of the genre you're trying to, the world you're trying to impact, right? Was that the idea?
I don't know. I wrote the chapter a year ago, and I've purged it from my memory, but.
I love it. I know the book better than Adam does.
You do, actually, at this point. Like, I've never read this book.
So. I get it.
I can't watch my own comedy.
The only times I read it, I was proofreading. And, like, you always see the trees and not the forest, right? Yeah. But, what I found most striking about that that particular story was how delicate of a balance it is between being an insider and an outsider. Mm. Because if you're too, you know, if you're too deep in the domain, if you're an expert, if you spent years studying this one thing, then you fall into this trap of cognitive entrenchment where you take for granted assumptions that need to be questioned and you don't even know you hold them. Mm. Right. And on the other side, if you're too much of an outsider, then you don't understand the domain well enough to be able to, you know, contribute to it or predict how it's going to unfold. And, you know, I guess the only way to get around that is to have some great combination of breadth and depth where, you know, you maybe start from the outside, you develop your ideas without, you know, being too blinded by what everyone already believes in the domain. And then you kind of, you come in and you try to understand it enough to be able to connect what you're doing to what the people who are involved in it already like.
Well, and, you know, it reminds me of the whole thing about inattentive. Eli Lilly had, you know that story, I'm sure, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So why don't you tell it?
No, you tell it.
You clearly have it top of mind.
You tell it.
Well,
since you brought it up.
So Eli Lilly
I know like the crowdsourcing story behind their work, which is so cool, but go on.
Yeah. But so Eli Lilly had all of these problems that they couldn't solve in house, no matter how much time and energy they put in. So they decided to put all these problems up on the web and offer cash bounties for anybody who could solve them. But the interesting thing was that it tended to be that the people who solved the problems were not experts in the field. It was people who were experts in an adjacent field, so they had enough understanding, to Adam's point, of what was going on, but they weren't so entrenched that they couldn't think in a creative way.
That's a really interesting, it's kind of like how you Uber or Airbnb out your problems.
That's right.
Seriously.
Yeah.
I never even thought of that. Well, Adam, do you have children?
I do. I have three.
How are you trying to raise them? What are the things that you're, you know, having done all this work, you obviously want your kids to be original as they can be. And oh God, having kids is such a balancing act because they kind of hate you. They kind of like, they're always like, you know, I'm not listening to you. I tried to teach my daughter something the other day and she put her hands over her ears.
Oh, no. Which,
yeah, it drives you crazy. But, you know, for me, like, it's like, I guess get them into learning an instrument, get them to do an individual sport, maybe a team sport, you know, get them to watch good things. Good movies with good you know messages and then hopefully they start to read and hopefully they're in a good school. But are you doing something different?
Well, you know, one of the joys of writing a book where you do a whole chapter on parenting mm-hmm. is you get to confront your own hypocrisy yeah. all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, like I wrote this whole thing right about like it's more important to teach values than rules, mm-hmm. and. I catch myself just the other day, like our kids misbehave and I hear myself saying, new rule. And then of course it never gets enforced. So it's pointless all around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's much, you know, it's much easier to catch this stuff in hindsight than it is to do in the moment. But the big lesson that I've taken away from a lot of the parenting research I've read is I really don't want to be one of those psychologists who screws up our kids.
Mm. Yeah.
And you know, it's actually a lot easier to screw up your kids than it is to do right by them. And so, like, avoiding really bad behaviors, you know, where they feel, like, abused physically, yeah. mentally, you know, is, like, that's the first and most important responsibility of a parent. And if you do that, like, if you avoid that stuff, you're already in pretty good shape.
Yeah, if you just love the shit out of them. But let me tell you, at the Tim Tebow Foundation, there were some these people were all, most of them are just good people. They're wealthy. They're successful. And I was sitting at a table full of just the nicest, the good looking, nice and successful people who were there to help kids. And they couldn't have been nicer to me. And they were funny and we were laughing. And I thought, this is a great group. And we were going to play golf the next day until I offended Tim. And I wasn't asked. No, but we were having a good time. And one of the things we started talking about raising our kids. And they were kind of, and you could see they were all, as far as I could tell, pretty, they'd all grown up together. They had very strong bonds. And I was like, man, sometimes I just, you know, I don't know how to raise them. Sometimes you just get so frustrated, you just want to throw them through a wall. Ha, ha, ha. And they said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I've been there. I mean, listen, if you hit your kids, it's okay. We're from the South. We do things differently yeah. down here. And I thought to myself, ooh. Back in the day, I mean, that you know, taking a switch to your kids' legs, like it was not that uncommon and may not still not be in certain communities. If you think about Catholic school and kids who come from big families, my experience from people who come from discipline and even punitive discipline, to an extent, it's pretty heretical nowadays. I don't know that they're that screwed up, Adam. I'm not saying I hit my kids. I just couldn't do it. I've been too steeped in the new age here. But what about that stuff? I mean, how much of this psychology and how much of this stuff is screwing our kids up?
I mean, Adam, you have three kids. That's kind of perfect for an experiment.
Adam, clearly. Yeah. I doubt Adam beats his kids.
We need to work on your knowledge of statistics if you think three will lead to an experiment. Yes.
Listen, I went to the Trump School of Statistics, so, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, I do not even know where to start on this one. No, look, I think, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that the most important thing that kids need from parents is, you know, a secure attachment, right? To like, to feel that they're valued as human beings, supported, loved. That doesn't mean always being like warm and forgiving, right?
Right.
You also need to be tough and demanding.
Right.
But there's no reason why that needs to involve like a punch in the face.
Yeah, I agree.
But isn't that
thing a tooth? I agree with you. Yeah.
I think that's part of so many of the conversations that we have, you know, in the public are, you know, not nuanced. Like, you know, you argue about should we be conservative or should we be liberal? And the reality is you should be conservative about the things that work and liberal about the things that don't. Mm. But it's the same thing with a lot of this stuff is that when you hear people who are talking about, you know, using corporal punishment on their kids, they tend to think that the alternative is having no boundaries, being totally loosey-goosey, the kids run around and do whatever they want. And what you want is to have boundaries for the kids, but they're, you know, based on emotional boundaries and respect and all that sort of stuff, rather than boundaries that are enforced with a switch.
Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at parents who raised truly creative children, you do see this great emphasis on values and character, which I found to be so interesting. And, you know, it first intrigued me when I was, you know, when I was studying, you know, like, how do you raise a giver instead of a taker? And I realized I was delivering praise all wrong to our kids. So I always thought what you should do is, you know, you wait for a moment of like spontaneous generosity and then you reinforce the behavior. You know, like our daughter shares a toy and I'm like, wow, thank you for sharing. That was so nice of you. And then I read all this research that says, no, what you should say is, wow, thank you for being a sharer. You are a nice person.
Right.
You praise the character, not the behavior, and then they internalize it as part of their identity. And the next chance they have to do something like that, they're like, wow, this is who I am. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to repeat the behavior.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've been calling my kids helpers since I read the book.
Well, that's just awkward.
I heard my wife say, do you want to help? Why don't you help your sister? And then my wife, she goes, do you want to be a helper? She corrected herself. she pulled an Adam Grant. Do you want to be a helper? So yeah, you've indoctrinated the household. Keep going. Keep going.
I'm a little frightened to hear this, but
yeah.
What probably, you know, came out of that was realizing, you know, you can apply this in lots of ways, right? So like these families that raise creative children, one of the things you see them doing consistently is saying, well, excellence is important to us. What kind of success do you want to achieve? Or we really care about respect and integrity. Let's talk about what that means to you. Mm-hmm. And by engaging in kids in dialogue about who they want to be, they take much more ownership over this value system. And then when they grow up and they have to, you know, stand against convention or, you know, buck a crowd, they're much more likely to say, well, these are my values. I chose these principles. And so I'm not going to worry too much what other people think. And, you know, I guess I've been trying to, you know, like when our kids do really creative artwork, instead of saying that's really creative, like I've started saying, wow, you are really creative. And I imagine when they're teenagers tempted to do stuff that, you know, I would prefer them not to do, that instead of saying like, oh, don't be a sheep, I can, you know, I can say you are a nonconformist. And then maybe they'll just ignore everything I say and not conform to me.
Well, you open the book, Creative Destruction, the first chapter, The Risky Business of Going Against the Grain. You open the book with a great quote from George Bernard Shaw. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. This kind of goes back to what you're saying. I doubt his parents said that to him, but you know, it's the example stands that you've got to kind of it takes so much courage to, and I know you touched on this a little bit, to stand by your idea even if you do a lot of research. There's a lot of rebuttal out there. So when somebody says, yeah, that's your idea sucks, or your idea, because that's kind of what it's about out here, man. I mean, my God, ISIS is a bad idea. It's a bad idea. And you think to yourself, I do think some people just need to be bombed into oblivion because they're shitheads. But
yeah, but you also have to remember, it's a bit why even a bad idea is appealing for a reason. It solves a problem. So what is the problem that ISIS solves?
Well, I think powerlessness.
Powerlessness.
These are young men who want to feel powerful, significant. They want to have some dignity. And you know, the idea is Amos Oz, that I never forgot that quote. The great Israeli writer said, the way you beat a bad idea is with a good idea. That seems to be always where the battlefield is. Look at our political system. You've got Bernie Sanders, who's essentially a communist. and then you've got someone like Ted Cruz, who is so far to the right that he was one of the orchestrators of the government shutdown, from what I understand. And this guy is his two accomplishments were, you know, to shut the government down and make sure everybody in Washington, including people in his own party, dislike him. It's interesting, man. It is a competing. Those are two extremes, and they're the loudest examples. But I always feel like, you know, we kind of ride and die on the idea that wins the day, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a sad amount of truth to that. And I guess, you know, like John Stuart Mill wrote about the marketplace of ideas long ago and said that, like, over time, it's efficient. right? That like as the world moves forward, as time marches on, like better ideas get selected and worse ideas, you know, will get weeded out. And, you know, I guess like John Maynard Keynes warned us about that kind of thinking and said, in the long run, we're all dead. And if, you know, if the long run is too long, then we're going to be stuck with a lot of horrible ideas for a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to navigate the tension between those two things, which is why I turned to you guys.
I side with Mill, though, Adam.
Yeah, but the process is, the question is, what is the process by which those ideas are being selected out? Because historically, a lot of these bad ideas had to be pursued to the end of the line, and a lot of people had to die before those ideas got abandoned. Like, you know,
but think about how things go now. Like for example, Malcolm Gladwell or Adam Grant are people who are sitting there thinking and writing and spending all that time. The ideas do get out there.
Well, I'm gonna let me put a caveat on that. Mm. And this is actually something I wanted to ask you about, Adam, in terms of the New York Times audience, because it seems to me that there are a tremendous amount. Like, there's a really good science to narrative chain between essentially academia and people who read the New York Times. Like, that's who tends to read these books, but they don't really move beyond that. They don't necessarily move into the Arab world. They don't necessarily move into the vast majority of the U.S. population. I don't think that these ideas, I think these ideas are moving a little bit, but I don't think that they're really moving into, like, it's not like Trump supporters have sat around and they, like, have read all of Malcolm Gladwell's books and all of Adam Grant's books and are like, having synthesized all these things that these guys are saying, we now think that Donald Trump is the best choice.
What do you think, Adam?
I don't know. I would love to see some data on that. I actually think there are lots of like very curious conservatives out there, mm-hmm. Who, you know, who do read this stuff and think about it in, you know, ways that are pretty similar to what you see with a liberal audience.
I'm not making this about a liberal conservative thing, though. Even if there's a percentage of conservatives who read this stuff, this is not some sort of liberal chauvinism. I'm just saying that the majority of these ideas don't necessarily translate into the wider public. Carol Dweck has been working on growth mindset for 40 years. She has so much research. And if you go out and you talk to the majority of kids and parents, they still go around talking about things like the math gene.
Yeah, but, you know, listen, we do know a lot of people who talk about the 10,000-hour rule. There are certain things that are
but
so catchy.
But do they
catchy.
Live it? There are lots of... Yeah, they talk about it, but there's a difference between...
No, but let me give you another example. There are kids now who, because of the new science about genetics, there are kids who are taking... They're taking cheek swabs, and they're finding out that their kids don't have a high ratio of fast-twitch muscle. And this is really true in the South, and they're going, well, your football's not your thing. You just don't have the explosive power. So instead of spending all this money on practice and training, let's choose another sport you might be better at, like endurance or tennis or whatever. What's happening. But some ideas do get out there.
Some ideas.
I'm not saying that swabbing a child's cheek to see where he fits into society. This isn't Plato's Republic.
But again, there is a discrepancy, right? Mm-hmm. In the same way that you look at Elon Musk and you're like, oh, long bone length, right? There's a human bias towards things that are visual and visible, right? There's a whole bunch of stuff that floats around the internet about photoshopping images of women's bodies on magazines and, like, you know, unhealthy expectations about, you know, how you should look. There's almost nothing about unhealthy expectations of what smart is. Right. Mm. We talk about this stuff, but the general public does not. There's a giant discrepancy.
What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I think that, you know, it's unfortunate that we don't have better ways to make, you know, some of these invisible things visible. You know, there was a great infographic that went around a few months ago that was based on Carol Dweck's work. And like it showed do's and don'ts as far as raising kids with a growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset. And, you know, like I found it so practical and so concrete. You know, it said like instead of, you know, when your kid says math is hard, instead of saying like, oh, you're not good at math, which no one actually says, but apparently some people think, you should say, oh, that feeling of math being hard is the feeling of your brain growing.
Ooh. Ooh, I like
and
that.
It's like, okay, if we did more of that, these ideas would get out there.
But yeah, you know, that's the same thing with the psychology of stress. Instead of saying, get rid of your stress, what they'll tell people now is, you know, is hey, this is just your body getting ready for action. That's what's going on. And if you embrace that notion, it's actually good for you because you produce endorphins, and endorphins can be a bonding chemical and all that other stuff. So don't fight the stress. Embrace it. And this is kind of what a warrior feels like when he's about to go into battle, or this is what a lover feels like when they're truly in love, whatever it might be. And you can reprogram your brain to interpret the stimulus or the machinations that are going on in your body in a different way, in a more positive way that actually has a physiological benefit to you as opposed to something else.
That is like the perfect articulation of the joint message of why zebras don't get ulcers and the myth of stress. Mm-hmm. And you just summed up two books in one sentence.
Because I'm a smart guy. I'm a smart guy, Adam. That's what happens when you come on the Brian Callen /
You know, I was once told that smart people never claim intelligence as one of their virtues.
Damn it! Damn it! Yeah, but I'm an original.
Yeah,
I'm
you just keep digging, man.
I'm going against the grain, bro.
Anything that Brian claims to be, you immediately know he's not.
That's exactly right.
But that's the thing. And he has actually claimed that he has long limbs.
And I haven't talked about being an amazing lover. So,
no.
Notice how there's no correlation between long limbs and penis size as well, by the way. Just so you guys know. In fact, that's the inverse.
The myth that Brian is really committed to fighting.
If you have a short femur bone, you tend to have a longer dick, which is why shorter people are more intense. All right. I don't know what that means.
So instead of looking at Donald Trump's hands, we should be looking at his femur?
Well, I was trying to write a joke about how I think the slower a man moves, the bigger his dick, because he's already kind of won. But anyway, see, I like to bring it to that level, Adam, because Donald Trump talked about his penis in his hands, so there you go.
You are raising the bar on a daily basis for all of us.
That's what happens, brother. We shake it up. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, the John Stuart Mill thing versus Keynes, right? I don't think that the models are... I was at a mathematical biology conference recently in Poland.
Nerd!
Actually.
God.
One
does.
A lot of chicks?
No. But
sorry, Adam, you're in the university. I meant women.
Yeah, but I don't think that the long arc of history can be upwards, and at the same time, it can still be, chaotic along the way.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's, Better Angels of Our Nature, the general trend is for the world to get less violent, but that doesn't mean that there aren't these huge clumpy events like World War II where there's a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. And I think the real challenge is, let's imagine that that civilization, this global village that we've created collapses. Well, there will be humans and they will dig through the ashes and it'll be abundantly clear to them. They won't have the pride and the arrogance that we have. And they'll say, oh, here's all the ways that they screwed up, right? They had these crazy notions about stress and genius and all of that sort of stuff. And this is how you should do it. And they would build it better. But the question is, do we want to go through a collapse event to, drop our arrogance? Or do we want to be like, oh, maybe we're not doing everything totally the right way. Maybe we don't all know exactly what we're talking about.
I'm going to put my money on the latter.
Me too.
I think that's the point. We've been through the whole, let's build a civilization and have everything collapse so many times that I don't know that we need to do that one again.
Well, but I think, don't you think, Adam, that, you've got to be careful with the idea that there is an answer. For example, that there is one single truth. Somebody defined wisdom. It was David Brooks' book, in The Road to Character. He said, wisdom is essentially recognizing your limitations and then knowing what to do with them. If you're a moderate person, it doesn't mean you're not passionate, and it doesn't mean you're not lazy, and you have both. You go to both ends.
Yeah.
But moderation is learning sort of how to balance these competing interests, these vices and these virtues.
Aristotle said that wisdom was basically the ability to, temper your your strengths so they don't become weaknesses, and to balance against multiple virtues.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I noticed we are probably running on end of time.
Yes, you're a busy man.
I just wanted to say that one of the true marks of a giver is somebody who laughs at your jokes instead of hogging the stage with his own. And you guys are so good at that. I feel like most of the time I interact with comedians, like, they want to be the ones who are making other people laugh. And you've almost created the illusion that I'm funny with your responses. Which I greatly appreciate.
That's what I do, my friend. I'll get you up on stage, or at least I'll get you to one of my shows.
I love that, Adam. You should do stand up. That would be so great. Like, if you took all of the stuff that you knew, all of the psych stuff, and did stand-up to move those ideas, I think that'd be incredible.
I don't know about that. He's doing just fine, just writing.
I think he's doing great, but I would love to see. If Adam Grant did stand-up...
I'll tutor you, Adam, anytime you want.
I think that'd be amazing.
I think we should try a joint routine and see how it goes.
I think that'd be great.
There it is.
I will pay money for that.
You just toss up some ideas, and I'll go with them. I'll improvise on what was that word? What were the two words that were?
Optimal distinctiveness.
hey guys, what's the deal with optimal distinctiveness?
The other one that I love too is naive realism, which, you know, like, yeah, you can wade through it and be like, oh, I get what that means, but nobody hears naive realism and is like, oh, I totally do that.
Naive realism. Well, listen, man, it's all about getting these great ideas out to the world, and you seem to be doing your part, Adam Grant. What are you working on next?
That is something I've not yet figured out. I hope to have some free time to think about it in the next few months, but I would really love to understand what we could do to get more people to admit that they are occasionally wrong. Mm. And I think if we could start there, the world would be a slightly better place.
You know, I've been trying to do that in my own life. I had such a judgment on Kanye West. I hated him. I wrote jokes about him, and I realized after a while. But then I said, this guy is very, very popular, and I know people who are pretty intelligent that really like him, and he's produced a great volume of work. And had a real influence, and I said one day I said, all right, that's it, I'm gonna buy, and all my information had come from sound bites and what other people thought of him, and I said to myself, well, I'm going to listen to all his music, really listen to it, and read the lyrics.
Just be careful about the stuff he says that doesn't have music behind it.
Yeah, well, but you know what? That's part to my point is I listened to all his music, not so much my kind of music, but the man puts out a real variety of sound. He is never staying comfortable. He's always producing and working with really good artists and stuff. So his work is hard to deny. I don't know music well, but then I started listening to his interviews, and to my shock and there is a lot that Kanye West says that I agree with, and
you heard it here first.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm going to go on record as saying yes, he has a big ego. Yes, he's prone to arrogant outbursts, but that's not the man. And part of what I was sort of pushing away was the fact that he was, I think, reminding me that I needed to do more work, that he was his refusal to put any kind of limitation on himself. It was what it was. He said, my heroes are Shakespeare and Mozart and Jesus and all these different figures that we were thinking, like, yeah, I'm just like those guys. Those are my heroes. Those are the people that I'm striving to be. I thought that's, you know, he's incredibly ambitious. But the point is, I came away with a different appreciation of Kanye West, ladies and gentlemen.
So do you think Mark Zuckerberg should invest $1 billion in Kanye West ideas?
I just don't know. But the lesson there is be careful how you judge. And it's probably a good idea to get into, if you don't like something, take a look at why. Sometimes it sheds light on your own limitations. So that's a profound
I could get
story.
Behind that. Well, yeah. Thank you guys for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Adam Grant, you're awesome. The book is Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. I am going to go do my podcast, The Fighter and the Kid, which got 2.8 million downloads this month. And I'm going to talk about this book on there as well. Sweet. I would have you on that podcast, but I don't think a lot of them read. That's so unfair to them. I love them. But I got great. There are a lot of young men who should be reading this book. I don't know. I don't want to speak for women. I just know that when I was a younger guy, I wish I had this information. So that's my job. All right, my friend. Adam, always welcome to come on and talk about anything.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you guys soon in Philly.
Yes, sir.
Talk to you later, buddy.
Thanks, Adam.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Awesome. The great Adam Grant. There it is. Well, Hunter, thanks for succinctly putting ideas into my head.
Well, thank you also. I mean, you know, I mean, Adam Grant recognized that, you know, you had pulled together, you know, two great books into one perfect sentence.
That's right? That just comes from years of training and experience.
It's a lot like what Jefferson did. You know, he read Montesquieu, he read, you know, Locke, all of those people.
Sure.
And then
so have I.
The Declaration of Independence. I mean, that was kind of what you did. The Declaration of Stress.
I'm compared to Jefferson all the time.
Yeah.
The only difference is I don't own slaves.
But you aspire to.
No. only white slaves.
Yeah, and female slaves.
From Eastern Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
With curves.
Yeah.
I'm not ISIS.
yet.
God almighty. We live in sensitive times. Anything like that can cause an uproar.
Yeah, but I think that's part of the problem is that we live in two sensitive times, and then you don't get to have conversations where you actually figure out the ideas.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, people that are... oppressed or have a history of oppression, you know, there's a lunatic fringe in those groups that kind of shuts down the entire debate because they're more interested in power, not change. So a lot of times you'll see people that just go after someone like Alec Baldwin because he called somebody a cocksucker. So apparently now he's a homophobe. It's ridiculous. He's not your enemy.
But
that's
it's also
not who to point your guns at.
Well, but it's, you know, the narcissism of small differences.
Yeah.
But the, I mean, point. Also, in, you know, what you were saying about, you know, to beat a bad idea, you have to replace it with a better idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the problem is that, for example, people who are racist, they have this very simplistic notion of how do you explain the differences between how white people and black people do in the United States. And rather than having a conversation where you start to understand the factors and understand, oh, you know, why do we get these different outcomes? What are the historical causes of all of that? Mm-hmm. They just are like, racism is bad. And
well, not only that, but if you start talking about, if you really want to get into the root causes of what creates deep inequality, why so many black men go to jail, while so many of these young black kids are not receiving the education that they need and stuff, you've got to get into some serious and sticky conversations about culture, about all these things. And the minute you do that, sometimes that debate gets shut down because you're 100%. You're being offensive.
Right.
If you really want to solve the problem, which I do,
and
if you really believe that black, white, Chinese, Latino people all have the same potential, which I do, and I think if you don't, you're just not very smart, or you just haven't done the reading. There's just overwhelming evidence that human beings, regardless of their skin and color and all this, is not a new idea. They all have the same potential.
Right.
You
but
just
that doesn't mean they have the same outcome. And those a lot of that difference in outcome comes down to beliefs.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter whether you're, you know, a white kid in suburban America who believes you didn't get the math gene or, you know, you're a kid in some poor third world country, you know. And that's I think, you know, the conversation that Republicans and conservatives have been wanting to have for the last 50 to 60 years is a conversation about values and culture, and liberals have been utterly unwilling to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And then they wonder, I mean, you know, I think there's this weird narrative, like when you hear people talking on, you know, Facebook or whatever about Trump and all of this sort of stuff, liberals tell this narrative that, oh, this is a thing that started 8 years ago. You know, because they didn't, and it's like, no, this is a forest fire, and that forest fire is because there has been a lot of dry kindling that has been building up for decades and centuries, and now, you know, you've helped build that up.
Yep, good point. Well, Hunter, thank you again.
Brian, thank you.
These conversations.
Yeah.
Rena Marie, thank you, our esteemed and wonderful engineer. This has been the Brian Callen Show, and I hope you learned something, because this is where you learn everything.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.